Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people have more intelligence or have brought it to bear with greater effect for a longer period of time than our first guest. He is Dr. Daniel Pipes, the founder and president of the Middle East Forum. He has served in various capacities in five presidential administrations. He has been an accomplished and very prodigious author. He is, among other things, a driving force behind something we'll talk a little bit about called the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus, and just an all-around go-to guy on the challenges we're facing, particularly in the Middle East, but more generally in terms of our national security as well. Daniel Pipes, welcome back, my friend. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you were my very first radio guest. So I thank you for returning to the scene of the crime. It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you for the new invitation and for the kind words.
My pleasure. Let me ask you about a subject that you have been writing about of late at the Washington Times, but that I know you have been tracking carefully for many, many years. And I must say, it confounds me. And that is the relationship between Iran and Turkey. Iran, of course, an unabashed enemy of the United States. Turkey, at least putatively, one of our close allies. What is happening and what does it portend, Dr. Pipes?
Well, I think there's a grand switch underway, which is to say that the Iranian government, which has been hostile for close to 40 years, is, I believe, rickety and could fall at any moment. It could also take some time. But it is in the process of moving towards us. And should there be a counter-revolution, I think that we will find in Iran a quite friendly country. Contrarily, Turkey, which is, as you point out, formerly an ally of the United States, is hostile and getting more hostile all the time under the leadership of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And I believe that it has more sound fundamentals, that the form of Islamism there is more intelligent, is economically more accomplished, and therefore has a brighter future as an Islamist government and therefore as an enemy of the United States. And therefore I see in, say, 10, 15 years, Iran being quite friendly, and Turkey being the great problem of the region.
This is a fascinating prognosis. Let me drill down on both parts of that. To what extent can we help foster the kind of transformation in Iran of which you speak? Is it by perpetuating the so-called Joint Cooperative Plan of Action, about which we'll be speaking more with Fred Flights momentarily? Or is that over the side? Are there things that we need to be doing that delegitimate this regime and support those who may wish to replace it with something far friendlier?
Well, you have sketched out the new approach I would advocate, yes. I would, as you suggested, start putting pressure on the regime and helping the opponents of the regime.
Something we might have done under Barack Obama, but he let the opportunity pass in favor of rapprochement with the Iranian regime.
But to be fair, something we might have done since the Carter administration, and no presidential administration has done that. So this would be a fundamental shift. We have always accepted the Iranian regime.
So let's turn then to Turkey. Turkey is, I'm told, a country we cannot remove from NATO, and therefore we will find ourselves as this metastasizing cancer of the Erdogan Well, I gather incipient caliphate continues to metastasize. What is it that we can do, Daniel Pipes, in light of what you're forecasting is a potentially quite serious strategic problem for us there?
You're right. The those who devised NATO some 65 years ago, almost 70 years ago, didn't think about it in pushing anyone out. It wasn't something that came to mind. So there's no formal apparatus to exclude, to dump a member. But what one can do is not invite them, not share intelligence with them, not sell them arms, and generally make them feel unpopular and unwelcome and not really part of the club, which the Turks are themselves doing. They're now on track to buy a very major missile defense system from the Russians. It's completely incompatible on a technical level, and it's completely incompatible on a political level. So this is happening bit by bit.
At their hand, but we are powerless, it appears, to facilitate their removal. It's a very, very troubling development, needless to say. And Daniel, one aspect of it is that the Erdogan regime, as you know so well, has been very intimately involved, if not very substantially responsible for the invasion, I think is no understatement, the invasion of Europe by Muslim, many of them, military-age males that have been increasingly compounding what you've described as Merkel's historical folly, of course, referring to Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. Talk about that bit of Turkish hostility and what it's doing to Europe at the moment.
Well, the Turkish government isn't fundamentally responsible for the situation. It's the civil wars taking place in Syria, and as well as many other problems in Yemen and Iraq and Lebanon and Libya and elsewhere. What the Turkish government is doing is saying to the Europeans and Germany in particular, we've got several million refugees, and we can turn off and on the spigot as we wish, so you better do what we want. That's really the role. It's not that they produced and created the refugee problem, but they are exploiting it. And it was almost exactly 2 years ago that Merkel said, the borders are open. Anybody who wants to come to Germany may do so. And a flood of illegal, what had been illegal, but now I guess legal, migrants entered into Europe and headed towards Germany and secondarily towards Sweden, tertiarily towards Austria and France and elsewhere. I think this was an astonishing decision that she made that will have major repercussions for many years to come.
And how would you characterize those as we speak? I mean, it's evident that some of the chickens have already come home to roost, more maybe in the offing. But where are we right now with respect to the effects of this historic mistake?
What we're seeing is an increase in polarization in Europe, whether it be West versus East, or elite versus population, or populist versus establishment. An increasing polarization of views on the migration, particularly by Muslims from the Middle East, or in general Muslims, who are the most difficult to assimilate, and who come with their own notions of being a superior civilization, and so this argument, which has been underway for decades now, just became that much more agitated and intense as a result of Merkel 2 years ago. And one sees all sorts of new fissures developing in Europe, particularly striking as the one between East and West, former Soviet countries and former American allies, one might say. Their views towards this are dramatically different.
And what is happening within their societies, of course, is somewhat different as well, and particularly with respect to those erstwhile allies of ours, particularly ominous for Western civilization, I think. Daniel Pipes, there is so much more to talk with you about, but we're not going to do it today. Alas, there is no more time, but I thank you so much for the great work that you and your colleagues do at the Middle East Forum and for your contributions to all of our understanding of these extraordinary developments and what they might portend. for not only the moment, but for the future as well. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll also keep coming back to us. Thank you for being our first guest, as well as the current one. Thank you also for your good friendship. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Hans von Spakovsky about sanctuary cities and voter fraud and more, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's great to have with us Hans von Spakovsky, one of the great legal minds of our time, certainly a man with considerable experience in some of the public policy issues that are shaping our time, notably matters involving immigration and voter fraud. He comes to these by virtue of, in part, service in the United States Justice Department as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. He's also served for 2 years as a member of the Federal Election Commission. These days, he is serving on the President's Commission examining voter fraud. And he is a great resource, a good friend, and a man we're always pleased to have with us as a guest. Hans, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Frank, it's great to talk to you again.
Let's start with the sanctuary cities issue. Hans, I have to say, this is one of those things that just drives me to distraction because it would seem on the face of it to be such an affront to our rule of law in this country. What on earth is going on here? And where do things stand now that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has put the hammer down on these cities and I guess even states that are trying to willfully ignore federal law?
Well, the latest is a lawsuit filed by the city of Chicago. What the Attorney General has said is the Justice Department gets about $4 billion a year from Congress to give out to states and local governments in grants. These are discretionary grants. You know, these aren't entitlement funds. These are discretionary grants cities have to apply for. And it's supposed to be used to improve, you know, their law enforcement and security, et cetera. What the Attorney General said was, if you're going to apply for these funds, you have to certify that you are going to be in compliance with federal laws.
It seems like a fairly modest but necessary step, doesn't it? What is going on with these sanctuary cities and their willingness to take federal money but not to comply with the prerequisites, namely compliance with federal law, Hans?
Well, one of the federal laws they're talking about is there's a provision in the Federal Immigration Act that says that localities like Chicago can't forbid their local law enforcement from exchanging information with the feds on the citizenship status of individuals, particularly people who've arrested. So in other words, you know, they can't tell the chief of police in Chicago, you cannot talk to federal immigration authorities if you arrest an illegal alien. You can't do that. That's not asking a lot. Chicago got last year a little over $2 million from the feds through one of these grants and said, well, you can't do that. You can prohibit us from banning our folks from talking to you. The other thing they objected to was the Justice Department also said, if you're going to get one of these grants, you have to agree that to the extent you can, you will notify us, the federal government, 48 hours before you release an illegal alien. So if somebody, if an illegal alien in Chicago has been arrested for assault, for example, and sentenced to 6 months in jail, well, 2 days before they're going to let him out, they've got to notify the feds. Why? So the feds can come pick him up and deport him. And Chicago objected to that, too. You know what's so odd about that, Frank, if you think about it, is a lot of these criminal illegal aliens have extensive criminal records. You know, they're not in jail once. They are repeat criminals. And yet, what is Rahm Emanuel saying? He's saying, I would rather that these criminal aliens be re-released into our local community where they can then victimize more residents in further crimes. I'd rather they be released back in our community than have to call the federal government so they can be picked up and deported. And that's what they're suing about. They're saying these conditions that the feds are putting in are just too much, and they want a judge to say Jeff Sessions can't do this.
Yeah, even in advance of him actually doing anything, as I understand it, which is its own problems from the legal standpoint. Let me ask you, Hans von Spakovsky, when you talk about this, it seems as though the public must not agree with what is being done in their name, especially since I assume that these sanctuary cities actually prove to be magnets for more of these folks who are going to understand very well that they're not going to be turned over to ICE. They're likely to be able to continue not only to live in those communities, but also to prey upon the people in them. Is that right?
It is. In fact, the polling on this shows pretty clearly that a majority of the American people don't like the idea that illegal aliens are going to be protected, criminal illegal aliens are going to be protected and given more rights than ordinary citizens. But, you know, this is apparently the politically correct thing to do. There are a lot of advocacy groups like La Raza and others who help support these kind of Democratic mayors. And I got to tell you, a lot of this, too, is, and we know this is a problem in Chicago, it is easy for a non-citizen to register, to vote, and their chances of getting detected are just about nil because the city of Chicago does absolutely nothing to actually verify that you're a citizen when you register to vote. And I can tell you, a lot of Democrats like Rahm Emanuel, they want non-citizens in the country. They want them registering. They want them voting. They see it as a political power advantage to them, and they know the polling again shows non-citizens break about 80%, 20% Democrat versus Republican.
Well, this brings us to the next topic, which is, of course, your considerable experience with trying to root out and otherwise stop voting fraud. Notably, the book you co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote to Risk, and of course, your present service on the President's Commission on Voter Fraud. What on earth is the story there as well? Do people not appreciate? I was listening this morning to a program that talks about how they're going to let non-citizens vote in local elections. I think this is not necessarily new news, but it is extraordinary, isn't it, Hans, that we're watching the unraveling of the value of citizenship in this country in a way. If somebody who doesn't belong here can vote, it neutralizes mine, doesn't it?
It certainly does, but that's the push from the progressive left and has been for years. Look, about 20 years ago, they realized that the only way to cement their political power was to bring as many non-citizens of the country as possible. And part of that is getting them to vote. And all of that is part of this whole push that they have done in the media and elsewhere to extinguish the line between legal immigration and illegal immigration. You know, if you're against illegal immigration, you're labeled as a racist, you know, a white supremacist, which of course is not true. We are the biggest and best country in the world when it comes to legal immigration. We take in more than a million legal immigrants a year. The fact that folks like me and the majority of Americans want to actually enforce our immigration laws against illegal immigration just means that we believe in the rule of law and we don't want an extinguishing between the lines. But that is exactly what the progressive left is pushing for, and that's why they want to basically give all the rights of citizenship to people who are here as non-citizens, even those who are here illegally, and that's why they're now starting with giving them the right to vote.
There is no question, it sounds in your mind, and certainly in mine, that there is voting fraud taking place, and it is being done purposefully to skew the vote and neutralize those of many of us who are entitled to vote in the interest of the Democratic Party scene. Hans von Spakovsky, you're exposing these facts, these hard facts, and helping at the Heritage Foundation counteract them as well as in your other capacities. It's deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Come back to us again, please, very soon. Christine Bim joins us next. We'll talk about free speech, what's left of it in America, and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Christine Bim, a longtime friend and colleague of mine, now the founder of Paratus LLC, a risk communications consultancy, is in the house, at least virtually. She worked for a number of years as the chief operating officer of the Center for Security Policy. She has supported government clients, Fortune 500 companies, especially in the IT and aerospace industries. And she has one of the great strategic analytic minds of our time, as far as I'm concerned. She is always a welcome guest here. Christine Bim, thank you so much for joining us.
Frank, thanks so much for having me.
Christine, we wanted to visit with you in particular about some thinking and work that you have been doing on a very, very sensitive topic, the state of free speech in this country and the ability of many of us to practice it in the face of efforts clearly intended to stifle it, if not deprive us of it altogether, that constitutional freedom. Some of this has been emanating from the Islamists who don't like us exposing what they're doing with respect to stealth jihad, among other things. Some of it's been coming from their allies on the left, notably the Southern Poverty Law Center. Would you talk a little bit about this collusion in suppressing free speech and what it means for all of us?
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center is really right now the leader in the United States in trying to enforce not just censorship on what they're calling hate speech, but which is in fact any kind of political speech that is not progressive as they define it, but also any speech which is not in line with Sharia doctrine as the SPLC and their allies define that, including a group that they work with closely, the Muslim Public Affairs Committee, but they've also partnered with CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, and others.
Now, when you say Sharia doctrine, Christine Bim, I think what you really are getting at is this idea of Sharia blasphemy restrictions, which essentially prohibit at pain of death any offense being given to Islam, to Muslims, to their prophet, to their Quran, what have you. Is that right?
Statements of fact about Islam are forbidden if they cause any kind of offense or reputational damage to Islam. So what under the OIC's definition of slander, for example, it simply means anything that they consider offensive, very close to what we consider triggering on the far left. Hate speech is defined by the Europeans, by the SPLC, and increasingly by Democratic Party, and certainly by the media, falls in the same line. It's really anything that is not progressive speech is now increasingly defined as hate speech. Other synonyms they use are white supremacist speech and variety. So it is the red-green axis, the far-left axis, with the Islamist supremacists.
And so how is that being expressed at the moment by the SPLC as it's increasingly seemingly capitalizing upon, I don't know whether we can say they're instigating, but they're certainly capitalizing upon this frenzy to remove Confederate statues and otherwise engender, you know, a civil unrest over the history of this country. What are they doing now that is amping up this threat to freedom of speech dramatically?
The SPLC and its allies at this point are doing what I would call unrestricted warfare, which is a concept devised by the Chinese to oppose the United States. And this means that when you can't win politically or militarily, in the case of the Chinese, you use every other means you can, legal, financial, economic. So, for example, the SPLC with tech company allies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Cloudflare, which is a company that protects websites, GoDaddy is YouTube, which is owned by Google, is attempting to deplatform or to remove, certainly to censor, any group which is not progressive. And this isn't just neo-Nazi groups. This is groups like Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch or Pamela Geller's websites or the Christian Post, which is a Christian group which had its videos demonetized from YouTube. Act for America, which is had PayPal remove support. That you could go on and on and on. And it's an attempt, it's a shock and awe attempt of a coordination of Silicon Valley far left dominant groups, what I call Big IT. Big IT in coordination and under the guidance of SPLC, using SPLC's hate group list, which is an extraordinary slanderous list, which combines wonderful groups like the Center for Security Policy and others with groups that are far more problematic. But regardless, under the First Amendment, they all have a right to first speech. What SPLC list is being used for by all of these tech groups is to deny that right to as many groups as they can. In combination with them is a group called ProPublica, which is a think tank, a sort of far left group, which in combination in partnership with Al Jazeera Media, quasi-journalistic investigative research, which one of whose major partners in this effort against so-called hate speech is Al Jazeera Media, AJ Plus, along with SPLC. So that once again, we see the coordination of the Muslim Brotherhood and the OIC through the person of Al Jazeera here in this attack on free speech in the United States to create lists of what they're calling hate incidents. The broader goal, I would argue, is to create a parallel system for reporting anything that's called a hate incident, which will include hate speech, rather than just hate crimes. It's a great expansion of the existing hate crime laws, but also the hate crime reporting system that we currently have in the United States to reflect something much closer to the worst of the hate crime, hate speech laws in Europe, specifically hate speech, and also for that matter, the hate speech blasphemy laws that are now in Muslim majority countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan.
Despite our First Amendment freedoms, this is extraordinary. And Christine, talk a little bit about what's going on the Hill with respect to this kind of restriction being formalized in, if not statute, certainly resolutions being promulgated there.
Well, the Senate has actually passed a resolution. It's not a bill as such, but it's a resolution which condemns not just hate crime and any other form of racism, religion, et cetera, but it also condemns any animus targeting a minority in the United States. Now, animus is a pretty general word. It's hostility, ill feeling, strong dislike. And it also calls for federal investigation, not just of hate crimes, but of hate incidents and hate threats, both of which are undefined. And we know from past experience that the SPLC and Sharia doctrine in Muslim countries both define statements of fact about doctrine or about behavior as hate speech and as a hate incident. And we see this new Google effort as well as defining any statement of fact as potentially hate speech if it falls into their set of forbidden speech. We also have a bill, and this is an actual bill that has been submitted. It has 49 co-sponsors. It's H.R. 1566. On the Senate side, it's S-662, which basically implements a complete parallel new system for reporting hate incidents, as well as a right of civil suit, a federal right of action, for anything that is defined as a hate incident. This parallels this system that Google is setting up with ProPublica for people to report any kind of hate. What this specifically does is it says it doesn't have to be reported to law enforcement. It does not have to be considered a crime under law enforcement. It's just a separate, privately managed reporting of hate incidents, which then the court can implement as a right of civil action. So this is an attempt to create the equivalent of a parallel legal system for hate speech.
And further restricting our freedom of speech, of course. Christine Brim, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us both with updates and further insights into this. It's tremendously important. Christine Brim, the founder of Paratus LLC, longtime member of our team at the Center for Security Policy. Thanks for this very important contribution. Come back to us soon. Fred Flights is up next. We'll talk with him about the latest on the Iran-Obama bomb deal and more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional, now the senior vice president of the Center for Security Policy, with responsibility for policy and programs at the center. He is a man who has served his country with great distinction in the analysis business at the Central Intelligence Agency for two decades as the chief of staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the State Department and as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author, most recently, of Obama Bomb, a dangerous and growing national security fraud. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, speaking of Obama bomb, we are living with the consequences of this deal. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Fred, is that the Iranians have announced this week that if the deal is undone, that they will be able to enrich to weapons grade, highly enriched uranium, within just 5 days' time. What does that tell us about the effectiveness of this deal in actually neutralizing the Iranian threat?
I think it's very disturbing, and I want to correct the record because the media has been misrepresenting this. But let's keep in mind here that the Obama administration said this deal would keep Iran a year away from a nuclear bomb. Now, the Iranians said they could enrich uranium to 20% within 3 to 5 days at any time. Now, 20% is about 80% of the way to weapons-grade uranium, which they could probably make in 2 to 3 weeks. But the fact that they claim they could make 20% uranium that quickly, which is frankly that they shouldn't have, is very disturbing. It just shows that this deal is an out-and-out fraud. And the fact that they're claiming that they can do that, and I'm sure they can, it's just a matter of repiping the centrifuge machines that are currently allowed. They're allowed to operate over 5,000 centrifuges while the deal is in effect. They just have to do a little bit of repiping, and they can easily make the 20% uranium and then make the step to weapons-grade uranium, which is 90% uranium-235.
And Fred, I guess this raises the question as to whether or not they may already have stashed away actual weapons-grade uranium. Is that out of the realm of the possible based on what we know about their caches of secret facilities and materials in them?
Well, you know, experts are divided on that. Personally, I don't think they have weapons-grade uranium. I don't think they have secret caches of nuclear weapons. But there are many experts who disagree, including former CIA Director James Woolsey and my colleague Claire Lopez here at the Center for Security Policy. And when I hear these analyses, I say, you know, you guys might be right. Our intelligence agencies have been horribly wrong so many times on WMD programs. Personally, I don't think Iranians are there yet, but I don't rule it out.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Claire Lopez, and I did want to just do a shout out to her for a terrific paper that she's just released. It's at the Center for Security Policy website, securefreedom.org. It mentions, among other things, something that's long bemused me, Fred, and I wonder if you've got an explanation for it. She notes that most of the countries that have gotten nuclear weapons have done so within, well, at most about 12 years. Others have taken advantage of the Russians or the Chinese or the Pakistanis or others to get up the learning curve more quickly. And yet we're told that the Iranians have been at this for something like 30 years and are still not there. It just seems incredible that that could be the case, especially since they, we know, have been getting help from some of the countries I've just mentioned, as well as, of course, North Korea. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's evidence of efforts by the current Iranian regime to pursue nuclear weapons since the 1980s, an intense effort in the 1990s. And I think Claire makes a point very clearly. What is the purpose of this nuclear program? Is it peaceful? I like to argue that Iran is the only nation in history to have a missile capable of firing 2,000 kilometers or longer without having nuclear weapons. These missiles are nuclear weapons delivery systems, and it doesn't make any sense that that is not the purpose of this program.
Hey, Fred, speaking of missiles, I did want to ask your thoughts about some photographs that have recently emerged from North Korea that suggest there may be some new additions to what has been, I think by any measure, an astonishingly aggressive pursuit of ballistic missile capabilities by the North Korean regime. What's the latest on that front?
Well, there were some photographs released by North Korea's state-run media with Kim Jong-un at a missile factory, and there were some photographs on the wall of two previously unknown or at least basically suspected missiles. We had to be careful about this because this might have been staged. One is called the Pukusan 3, which may be a solid-fueled ICBM. No one knows if this has been built or not, but it is a very dangerous thing because if the North Koreans have that, they could fire an ICBM at us with maybe 15 to 20 minutes preparation. The other is called the Hosong 13, which appears to be a three-stage ICBM, which may be liquid or solid fuel, and it is probably similar to a missile that was tested, the Hwasong-14, on July 14th, 2017. The most worrisome thing was that there was a picture of Leader Kim standing next to wound filament reinforced plastic casing for a rocket body. This is significant because this is really the ultimate in lowering the weight of an ICBM.
Do we have any indication as to how they came by this breakthrough?
I think that is something that really needs to be looked into. This is a very advanced technology. Well, first of all, most of these missiles seem to be based on old Soviet designs. But there are some recent information that possibly there have been missile proliferation from Ukraine to China and to North Korea and Iran. This really needs to be run down.
When you look at this sort of proliferation activity, Fred Flights, and I know you've been following it very closely for decades, notably during your time at the Central Intelligence Agency and also in the State Department and on Capitol Hill, is it the case as you see it today that there's not only a great deal of proliferation taking place to North Korea, but from North Korea? And what does that portend in terms of, well, for sure, other hostile states getting their hands on nuclear capabilities, but perhaps others as well, those who may not have the territory in which to deploy ballistic missiles, but who may well find a means of delivering nuclear weapons to shores like ours, perhaps by tramp steamer, namely, you know, terrorist organizations. Is that something we should be concerned about as well?
We should be very concerned about it because if you're a nation on Earth and you want to buy missiles, North Korea is the place to get them. North Korea has tried to sell missiles to at least 12 states, including Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Egypt. I can't name them all off the top of my head. It's also worrisome that North Korea and Iran now seem to have such a close cooperation in missiles that each of them is assisting the other program. They're both developing parts of developing an ICBM program. This means Iran could be exporting missiles soon if they're not already doing that.
Yeah. And of course, what's going on in the ballistic missile program, which is somewhat more visible, is almost certainly going on as well with respect to nuclear weapons to go aboard them. A frightening, frightening picture. Fred Flights, thank you so much for the tremendous work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I want to, again, thank both you and Claire Lopez for the bird dogging of the need to get out from under this joint cooperative plan of action, as it's called, the Obama bomb deal. Check out her paper at securefreedom.org, folks, and check out Fred Flights when he joins us again next week. Thank you, Fred. And I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.